Welcome to Forget the Box, the ultimate web series podcast. I'm your host slash Stareable community director Brie Castellini, and this is our season one finale. Naturally, it follows that we're talking all things distribution with incredible guest and CEO of PassionFlix, Tosca Musk. But first, some thank yous. Thank you to every single one of you who has listened to and loved this first season of Forget the Box. Thank you to the iTunes reviewers and the folks who tweet about the show every week. Thank you to all of our season one guests who I'll name drop at the end of this episode. Thank you to Stareable for making this podcast a thing in the first place. And thank you to the Stareable forum members over at community.stareable.com for asking smart questions and making this experience not just fun, but collaborative and educational. And now, on to the episode. Welcome to Forget the Box.
Hi, thank you.
So to begin with, can you tell everybody a little bit about who you are and what you make?
Sure. Hi, my name is Tosca Musk, and I'm the CEO of PassionFlix, which is a streaming platform that focuses on distributing and producing romance content specifically taken from best-selling romance novels. I direct a lot of these movies, and I also license movies from the studios and release them to the public.
That's very cool. So your big history in filmmaking is features, right? Feature films?
Yes, I may. My history is really in features and in television movies. I did a lot of TV movies for Lifetime, Hallmark, and ION.
So how did you get started in that?
I started in the film industry when I was 18. I got a summer job at Alliance Atlantis in Canada. A friend of mine was working in HR and they needed a temp to come in. So I was like, I'm going to come in. I'll do this job. That sounds amazing. And I worked for them for 3 days. That was the length of my job assignment. And right afterwards, they said, you're great. We don't want you to leave. I was like, oh, that's great. And so they kept me on for the entire summer. Then I went to university, and every summer during university, I would go back to Toronto and I would work for Alliance throughout my entire university degree. Sure. And then when I graduated, I went and worked on one of their shows and then moved to Los Angeles, and I worked for Alliance in Los Angeles.
What kind of stuff did you do for them?
I was the director of development for Cela Ward, focusing on television movies, specifically for Cela Ward. We had a four-picture deal with CBS.
Very cool. But you also have sort of a history in web series. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So I've also produced a web show called Tiki Bar TV. The creator is Jeff McPherson, and he started it in 2004. And then in 2005, Steve Jobs used the show to promote the iPod with video and put it on every iPod across the nation in the U.S., which was really amazing. And so Tiki Bar TV quickly became the number one downloaded video podcast in the world. We had over 500,000 unique subscribers per month. And in 2005, 2006, and 2007, that's a lot, especially since we released one video a month, and that was around 5 minutes.
Wow. So you say it's a filmed podcast, a video podcast. What in your mind makes that different from, say, the label of web series?
So there was no such thing as a web series when we made it.
Sure.
That's what they called us, a video podcast, because there were audio podcasts, and they didn't know what to call us at the time because we were the first. They called us a video podcast. And that's just what we call ourselves forever. And I, you know, at the end of the day, we were a web series. Mm-hmm. Every now and then we get a message saying, will there be a reunion? And then we, you know, joke about it for a minute and a half. And then we're like, probably not.
Why not?
It's a lot of work.
Fair
and
enough.
I run another company.
That's fair. So yeah, actually, that's a great place to jump into it, because today we're talking about distribution, which I think a lot of, especially short form filmmakers, don't really think about. They think, oh, okay, there's YouTube, so I should just put my web series on YouTube. What do you think somebody should do with a finished project? Like, what is the first step in your mind that they should do once they have a complete finished project to put out in the world somehow?
Well, I guess if you have a completed web series, you can just upload it to the web and try and get it out there. I mean, at the end of the day, there are so many different outlets for you to release series now. You could, you know, promote it through Instagram and Facebook. Mm-hmm. You could literally just use the Vimeo player and create your own page. Or you can put it on YouTube, because YouTube aggregates so many different viewers. And so potentially you'll get, you know, discovered, unless you have your own marketing base And that's what, you know, general social media will come in and actually help you to market that series.
So you, in your opinion, you think that more people should be self-releasing versus trying to find a distributor for their content that's external?
I like self-distribution because you have a lot more control over it, but you have to have a good marketing plan behind it, and you have to have, people have to be able to find you.
Sure.
So releasing it on your own and people not finding you is obviously not going to work. Mm-hmm. I love the idea of being able to release it on your own. That's what I've always done before, and it's always worked for me.
So about that marketing plan, then, what is some advice, especially right before they release it? Because I think people tend to just upload content and then hope that people find it because they tagged it well. But like when you say marketing plan, what does that look like?
Obviously, there's the first go-to is social media. So basically, if you're creating a web show and you want to get the word out there, the best thing from my perspective is setting up a solid Instagram account and getting people to follow you and letting them know when your series is going to be released and seeing how many people can join you. When we launched Passion Flicks, we started with a Facebook page and a small Instagram account. And when we launched and we had like 8,000 or 9,000 people with us on day one of release,
wow,
which is pretty huge for a startup. So these are all people that joined the platform before anything had been released.
Wow. So what kind of stuff were you posting before you had anything released?
We were telling people what we were doing and we were inviting them to be a part of it. I think it really depends on the topic, the subject that you are releasing on, because we went to a convention, a romance convention, and we gave a talk on what we were doing and we showed some trailers of a movie that we made and people got excited. And if you can, you know, create that movement and get people excited about something, then they're gonna join. They're going to watch.
So we've got some questions from filmmakers that we baked into this. We've got a filmmaker forum at community.sterrible.com where folks get on and talk to each other and sometimes ask our guests some questions. So I've got a question from Jules, a filmmaker named Jules. Jules asks, do you think it's worth trying to find a streaming service for your show after it's been up on YouTube for a while? For example, do you think it's worth getting a show on someplace like Amazon when it's available for free on YouTube already?
Yes. I say get to as many distribution outlets as possible.
Okay.
One does not preclude the other. I think that you should try and you should reach out to every different possible avenue of distribution and you should put your content on that.
And why do you say that?
Because, you know, each one of these distributors has a different group of people that pay attention to the content. So I don't watch anything on YouTube. It's not even remotely interesting to me. But I watch a lot on Amazon.
Okay.
So if you're going to upload a series, upload it to Amazon, get it on Amazon Prime, you'll make some royalties on there as well. And you have now your content on two different outlets. So if you can get it on iTunes, then you have another one. People don't always go to the same place.
That makes sense. That totally makes sense. So how does that affect the marketing plan you were talking about? Because I've heard people caution against distributing too many places because then it gets confusing for an audience to know where to go. What is your... How do you kind of bridge those two things?
I think that the more your content is shown everywhere, the quicker people are going to find you. So if you were marketing that your show is going to be released on Friday and I Googled it and I said it's now available on YouTube or Amazon or iTunes, it's not confusing. I know exactly where to go. And now I have Amazon Prime. I can go there. I don't want to go to YouTube, or I can go and download it on iTunes.
So you think it kind of gives people like sort of their a mixed bag of like, hey, if you want to watch it here, you can watch it here. If you want to watch it here, you can watch it here. But there isn't just one place that you have to go if you want to consume this content.
Yes, exactly. You want to make your content as widely available as possible.
Got it. But what happens when you're trying to show somebody that you've got a good viewership, but all of your statistics are strewn across 12 different websites? What do you do then?
Then I say, well done you for getting a whole bunch of clicks from a whole bunch of different sites. Well done. That's hard. You know, if you only have it all in one place, that one distributor is the one that controls your content 100%. Mm. So you don't want somebody else to control your content. You want the flexibility of being able to be anywhere. So if you say you have, you know, 10,000 people on YouTube, then you have 5,000 people on Amazon and, you know, 2,000 downloads on iTunes. That's great.
So you think from the perspective of someone in the quote unquote mainstream, or someone who might be looking to help you make more, or to help you get to that next level of your career, showing that you have fans everywhere, not like a ton of fans in one place, is actually more advantageous?
Yes, I do. I find it far more interesting because there are different demographics on each one of these platforms. So that means that your content speaks to so many different people.
That makes sense. So then let's talk about that for a little bit, because there are more and more these days specifically short form content distributors who are kind of popping up all over the place. Sometimes they're looking for short films, sometimes they're looking for short form series. In your mind, for especially a newer filmmaker, someone who hasn't really dealt with this world before, do you think there is ever a circumstance where it makes sense to sign an exclusive distributing contract so they can only distribute with this distributor?
Yes, if that distributor is going to be paying them a lot of money.
Only money? You don't think there's any other reasons to jump on an exclusive sort of bandwagon?
Well, that person's going to control your content. And so suddenly you no longer have control of your content, right? They have the rights to distribute it and you do not. Mm-hmm. So if they don't do a good job and they don't get it out there because they've shelved it for whatever reason, you have no recourse. So you need money. Money is a good thing. Otherwise you need a clause to get out of that contract. Like, they have to do a certain marketing spend. They have to get a certain number of people to watch your content or whatever, which is very hard to get. But otherwise, why would you give them exclusivity?
So how does a filmmaker who's, you know, a little bit newer to this, might not even have their own lawyer, how do you kind of come to the table with that sort of a negotiation in mind? How do you tell an indie filmmaker, like, these are the demands that you deserve, even if you've never made something before? Like, how do they feel confident, I guess, in that sort of situation?
I'd tell them that you can do it on your own. You can distribute this on your own. So the question that you need to really ask yourself is, what can this distributor do for me that I cannot do for myself? Distributors take a huge percentage of the sale, and they aggregate content in order for them to be able to sell it to the big players, mm-hmm. right? So that's how they have to, you are valuable to them, and it is your art and your creation. And it's wonderful if a distributor wants to pick you up, because that means that they see value in you as well. And obviously they don't make money unless you make money, but you know, you want to make sure that you have an out clause. Are they just putting you on iTunes? Are they just putting you on Amazon? Are they just putting you on YouTube? Or are they putting you into festivals and more things that you couldn't get into yourself, maybe?
So that actually is a great segue into another filmmaker question. So Meg asks, so what are the benefits of a distributor? What are the common pitfalls or red flags that indie creators should know about?
I did not have great experiences with distributors, so I created my own distribution platform. In general, I am a distributor now. So what are the pitfalls? They take all your money. You know, at the end of the day, distributors are there to make money for themselves. And so they'll find your work, and let's say they're able to sell it for $10,000. It's a short film. They sold it for $10,000. They're going to take 20 to 25% on top of the gross. So there's $2,500. And then they're going to take some sort of marketing fee of $1,000 or $2,000. So there's that. And then they take quite a bit. So at the end of the day, you're like, I just sold it for $10,000. I might get $2,000 or $3,000 of that. But that's not enough for you to make back the money that it costs for you to actually make that show.
And so what are some red flags that, you know, a distributor might bring to a filmmaker who is less experienced that they might not know to look for?
Well, a producer's rep is not a distributor. So that's one thing. A lot of times producer's reps will come up there and say that they are a distributor, but they're not. And they'll take 10% of the gross, and then they'll introduce you to a distributor who will take 25% on top of that.
What actually is a producer's rep? I've never heard of that before.
Producer's rep is somebody who comes in and says that they can help you get a sale. They're not actually a distributor. Then they're not actually a sales agent or a distributor. They will introduce you to sales agents and distributors.
Okay. And there's no value in that, especially for somebody who might not have a ton of connections?
There is value in that. You know, my world, I'm not a big fan of middlemen, and there are a lot of them. So it's a matter of trying to avoid them as much as possible. With regards to distributors, just make sure that you have a cap on your marketing spend, on their marketing spend, because oftentimes a distributor will go and they will bundle a whole bunch of films together. And depending on how they've negotiated all those films, they'll say, you know, you have to pay the marketing of up to whatever, $65,000. And you're like, okay, per movie. So that's a lot of money that you have to pay back before you even start seeing any kind of return. And you have to pay them the 25% on top of, you know, so you have this gross amount, you're paying them 25%, but then you still have to pay back the $65,000 after you've paid them the 25%. And suddenly you're just sort of in this pit hole, you know, trying to pay everybody back. And so you want to make sure that there's a cap on your marketing spend and that the marketing spend is used specifically for your project. So you don't want to use that $65,000 is not for them to fly first class to Cannes. That $65,000 is used to do posters specifically for your project, trailers specifically for your project. And you want to try and lower that marketing spend as much as possible without hurting your picture.
That's interesting. So the marketing spend that a distributor puts out like about your project comes from your fee. You essentially pay that out before you actually get paid for whatever you get. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you pay out everything first. You don't get anything until everything's
been
paid back.
That's fascinating. So the things that get paid out are, so marketing, the fee, just the flat fee for the distributor. Is there anything else that comes out of that you have to pay back before you actually start seeing any money from this deal?
Yeah, well, if you are a union project, you'd be paying residuals to the various unions.
Got it. That makes sense. And so another thing I wanted to ask you about is that, like, the types of contracts that you sign with distributors outside of exclusive or non-exclusive can tend to get a little complicated too. There are different types of usage in distributor contracts, right?
I mean, it can be anywhere from theatrical, daytime television, primetime TV, DVD, SVOD, AVOD. You know, your content can go anywhere. Generally speaking, when you sign with a distributor, they want all media in, you know, for however long the term is.
So do you have any experience, not necessarily you personally, but just you sort of having been a part of this industry now, have any experience with distributors who don't do enough? And as a filmmaker who has perhaps signed on to a contract with a distributor, how do you know when, like, they're not really doing anything and that it might ultimately not be worth continuing with this distributor? Do you have any experience in that?
Yeah, so much. I mean, at the end of the day, all of us make our movies and we think that they're the best. Mm-hmm. And so not doing enough with a distributor, you know, if they are not really putting together a good marketing package, if they are avoiding your calls and spending more time on another project, you've probably gone to the wrong distributor. Because the big issue, this does happen, it's not very common, but it does happen, is that a distributor will buy your content and shelve it because they don't want it to compete with another project. That's the worst. Because they literally will shelve it. They'll just so that it doesn't compete with the other project, they'll just put it on the shelf and it won't see the light of day. So they have a time period that they have the rights to distribute that content. And during that time period, they have that right. So be very careful who you sign with. Just do your research on that distributor.
So yeah, so that's actually a great jumping off point, because again, a lot of especially indie filmmakers tend to not really have experience with these sorts of conversations. So how can they prepare themselves if they don't really have a lawyer or somebody who's sort of knowledgeable in these ways? How should people be going about researching, especially newer distribution opportunities? How can they feel confident and prepared if they might not have experience in this sort of venue?
You can search all the work that they've distributed before. So finding out who they've distributed before, and do you recognize those movies? Are they in the same genre as yours? Do you feel that they created a good campaign? Do you like the trailer and the poster? You know, that'll give you an insight as to whether or not they might work for you. Because if you've gone and made, you know, a romantic comedy, but this distributor's strength is horror films, you're probably not working with the right distributor. Or you've gone and made a Christmas movie, but their strength is sci-fi. They're not speaking to the right buyers.
That makes sense. So how do you actually go about finding distributors? Because we've been kind of talking about this as if a distributor has come up to them, which does happen, especially at festivals. But if somebody has finished a project and they want to find a distributor, they don't want to self-distribute, where do they even start?
That's a very good question. I worked for a distribution company for a long time, so that's how I did it. AFM, you know, the American film market here in LA is a great way to, if you can see who's going, you'll see a lot of different distributors there. You know, that list will certainly provide you with who all's buying. If there's an independent film that was released that is in a similar genre to yours and you see who distributed that film, you can just contact their acquisitions department and send them a letter and a copy.
Can you talk about like sort of the common mistakes that filmmakers make when they're reaching out to a distributor, things that they should be careful about or things that they should be adding in that they tend to forget?
Doing your research on that distributor is really the best thing that you can do. And there's so much stuff that you can find online about everybody. So just make sure that when you're sending in something to a specific distributor that you really are going to the distributor that will market that type of material. So as I said before, don't send your romance short to the horror team. They're not going to pay attention to, they'll probably not even respond. So it might be the best romance ever, but the horror team's just not even going to look at it. So just do your research and make sure that you're approaching the right people, which can be hard because you don't know who to approach. But the more you sort of research into it, anybody in the acquisitions department can help you.
Is there any circumstance where a filmmaker is not finished with their project, but they would want to start shopping out to a distributor? Is there any circumstance where a project that isn't complete is appropriate to start approaching distributors?
No, I think you should reach out to distributors as soon as you have an idea. I mean, if you have a script and you think the script is great, you can start reaching out to people and saying, this is the genre that I'm making. Because distributors will help you with, so if you get somebody on board, they will help you with things like, this talent has value, this talent does not have value. I can sell it if this person's in the movie, I can't sell it if this person's in the movie. So if you have that ability and that to get to somebody at the script stage, then great. As long as you're not, you know, a lot of them will happily give you advice if they think that you're going to bring the project to them afterwards and you're not asking them for money.
Interesting. So the thing about it is distribution doesn't have to happen after you've made something. That it should be a consideration that you have from the very beginning.
Yeah, you should know about your market and you should know where you're going to be taking this. At the end of the day, you have to know who your audience is. And so if you're making something, who's your audience and who can get your content out to that audience? Here's Passion Flicks. They make romance novels into movies. I have this romance novel. It was a bestseller in India. And I want to make this really cool Indian romance. So let's chat with Passion Flicks and see if they are interested in coming on board now as the distributor. We don't need your money, but we would like you to come on board and distribute it. So I want you to buy it afterwards. So most likely in my case, what I would say is, all right, this is what I'll do. I'm going to buy the U.S. rights, all rights in the U.S. market for $300,000. And I want an exclusive release on Passion Flicks worldwide for 1 month on SVOD. And after that, you can have the rest of the world and I'll just own the US. And that's something that, you know, that's very helpful to a filmmaker because then they know that they have a guaranteed sale of $300,000, which is a lot of money in the small world. And they can then take that and go to other distributors and say, I have a US distributor. I think it helps a lot, certainly in raising funds.
So what about if a filmmaker doesn't have a lot of experience? Would that still be a consideration you would make in Passion Flicks or just in general as like understanding how distribution works? Like if somebody, this is their first project, they're, you know, newly out of film school, but they've got this great idea and maybe a great script to go with it. Like, is that enough or do you need something else?
So it's highly unlikely that I will give a lot of money to somebody who just got out of school to go and make their feature without a strong hand in the process, because obviously there's a big risk there. But I do think that there are some great filmmakers that come out of university, and it's fun and exciting to be the person that helps discover them. That is exciting to me. And also to give them that break, because it's really hard to get that break. But they would need to, I would put some strong people around them. So if they're looking to direct the movie itself, I would need to see anything that they've directed in the past to make sure that they are capable. And then I would want to have a very serious creative meeting with them. And I would surround them with a strong, very established director of photography and editor and make sure that the producer on board is one of mine.
Got it. But you would consider a pretty new filmmaker if you just were in love with the idea?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's interesting. And that's, I think, really inspirational for a lot of us who, you know, are just grinding it out, hoping that someday somebody will see us. So they would come to you through like the acquisitions thing. They would send you an email. Would they send you part of the script? What are you like looking for in terms of materials, especially in this sort of early stage thing that we're talking about, not with a finished project, but with a thing that they want to finish?
They would need to have a script. So you would approach them with a brief synopsis and the script. If they want to get something made, they need to have a script.
Interesting. Okay. I think a lot of people might be surprised by that, but I'm glad that we're getting this information.
What do other people say?
There's all sorts of advice on the internet that's like, oh, you don't need to write anything. You don't waste your time writing the script. Make sure you have a really solid one sheet and a pitch deck, and that's all you need.
Yeah, I don't care about pitch decks at all.
Really?
No. If I don't like the story, and if you can't write a script, then, you know, the conversation is mute. So everybody can write but writing a synopsis or writing a paragraph on the story, but not being able to write a script, it's not worth it to me. That's a lot of time and effort that I would be investing into writing the script and making sure it goes forward. I think there's a lot of value in new filmmakers writing scripts. They learn how to do it as well. And the more you write them, the better you become at it. So I used to be the director of development for Alliance Atlantis. So just speaking about the scripts, people would send in scripts every single day, and they send in, so you'd get, you know, let's say 100 projects a week, and one person has to read all of these. Mm-hmm. So make sure your first 10 pages are captivating. Make sure that you've done your research on how to write a script and that it's not, you know, 250 pages. And make sure that you're sending it to the right department. Make sure you're sending, if you wrote a holiday Christmas story, make sure you're sending it to the TV movie department. Don't send it to, you know, again, the horror film department. I remember because when I was doing it, they sent Saving Private Ryan to us and we were doing TV movies. But nothing I can do with Saving Private Ryan. But obviously Steven Spielberg could, you know, sending us Saving Private Ryan is not, yeah. There was a no from us.
So just transitioning a little bit, because I'm fascinated by romance. What do you prepare for directing a romance movie that you wouldn't for another one? Like what's something that's uniquely special to directing romance that isn't sort of in the cards for a non-romance style movie?
We have three specific areas that we focus on: connection, compromise, and communication. And that's what every single one of these stories has to be about, because that's what romance and love is about: connection, compromise, and communication. And so we want to make sure that when we are reading the script, when we're casting, when we are working with our talent or our team, that the story has empowered male and female, strong characters, and that they connect, communicate, and compromise. So those are our keys.
Any advice for indie filmmakers who want to make romance, and things that you hope the next generation of indie romance makers take into account when they're making their films?
Yeah, well, firstly, I don't think romance is only about intimate scenes. So I think you can make scenes beautiful and intimate without any clothes removed at all. You know, the advice that I have is just make sure that you have a very safe space for your actors. And, you know, it's difficult to portray love on camera and connection and, you know, that sort of chemistry. So the more you can provide them with a safe space and communicate with them, the better, ultimately. But I think that filmmakers in general should make more romance movies, and they should make more positive content in general. And some of the best movies out there are love stories. I mean, some of the highest grossing movies, Avatar is a romance, Titanic is a romance. So there are some really beautiful stories out there that are romances. And so, you know, don't think that romance is erotica.
That's a great place to end. So do you have any final advice for indie filmmakers of any genre, anyone looking to distribute their content, anyone looking to just make great content for not very much money? Any final words of wisdom?
I think the main thing that I can say is just keep doing it. You know, if you've been bitten by the filmmaking bug, you will not be happy until you have, made your films. And it is a long process, and it's difficult, and there's a lot of rejection, but it's so worth it in the end. And It's so fulfilling. So if you have the opportunity to make a film, make it. And if you wonder, should you do it now or should you do it next year, do it now. Just go ahead and make that film. And it's not hard to make a short film, but you can go out there and you can make that short film and you will learn so much from just making that first project that you'll know how to make the second project and then you know how to write a script. So just keep doing it.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Tosca.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. If you like this episode, remember to subscribe to Forget the Box on iTunes and leave a kind review, because the only way we're coming back for a second season is if everyone who loves this podcast tells at least two other people about it, who themselves will tell two other people about it, and on until the powers that be can't ignore our filmmaker pleas. And now, some personal thank yous. Thank you to Bernie Sue for being the first guest on this podcast, talking all things brainstorming and idea development. Thank you to Katie Tibaldi of Seeking Sublet for talking about the pre-production process. To Christina Rea of Seed and Spark for making crowdfunding seem doable. To Ashley Clements of Lizzie Bennett Diaries and Sona for demystifying casting and auditioning. To Allison Venor of Canvas Media Studios for breaking down hiring and joining a crew. To Kate Hackett of Classic Alice and The Long Dig for making contracts understandable. To Alex LeMay of Too Numerous of Credits to Name for explaining pitching and making it in the mainstream world. To Mary-Kate Wiles, Sinead Persaud, Sean Persaud, and Sarah Grace Hart of Shipwreck Comedy for providing pre-production support. To Yulin Kwong of I Ship It on CW Seed for solving common on-set problems and mistakes. To Joshua Caldwell of MTV Movie Award winner fame for explaining how intertwined production and post-production are. To Tom Pike of Personal Space and The Long Dig for making marketing pre-release seem possible and also kind of fun. To the Starable Fest speakers Chelsea Satkamp, Alex LeMay, Eugene Sun Park, and Jay Sibley Law for finally explaining audience building. To Tim and Najee of The Feels for thoughts on collaboration and low-budget, high-production value. And to Tosca Musk for this very episode about distribution and actually getting your series seen. Once again, thank you to Starable and the Starable community, and to all of you for listening. This season has been a gift, and I loved every second of it. One more time, I have been your host slash Starable community director, Brie Castellini, and a huge big thank you to Anna Eichenhauer, @QueerGermanGirl on Twitter, for our theme song. Play us out, Anna.